Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Alex Schumacher. Since January of this year, I've been volunteering at the Jean Nicholas Treader Collection in my spare time. I've been helping them catalog and sort through their radio and audio collections. The Treader Collection is a GLBT archive that's been housed at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus since the early 2000s. And as a young queer person myself, working hands-on in the archive has been life-changing and illuminating. And so I sat down with five of my fellow young queer colleagues at the Treader to talk about their experiences in the archive. I was hoping some of you guys could share some of your specific experiences interacting with pieces of the collection.
All right. Hello, my name is Ray Barney, and I'm a student employee here. Yeah, so we have a lot of different stuff here. I'm most familiar with like what I process, which has been a lot of personal paper collections, actually, a collection that I really like and think more people should engage with because it's really interesting and kind of fun. Is also really sad is the Anna Silva papers. There's a lot of photographs. There's like quite a few boxes of photographs and correspondence, documents that kind of show her membership in groups such as like Stir Fry, which was a group in the 1990s for like queer women of color in the Twin Cities. And like, I think they partnered with Soul Essence to do like music nights, but they also like had retreats to Wisconsin. And there's all these photographs of that.
My name is Myra Billen-Fibbs. I work at the Treader Collection, and I do gay oral history research. Two things really come to mind. One of them would be a collection that I processed was the Trans Youth Support Network records. And those were really intense because they were kind of like the day-to-day records of a nonprofit that was working with trans youth in Minneapolis that doesn't exist anymore. So it spanned everything from their organizational records, but also like kind of these like documents of life, like photographs of like dances that they had to their programming. There was artwork that people who lived there, or not lived there, but people who were served by that organization had made. We have a lot of kind of material like that in the collection that kind of bridges personal and becomes kind of, you get into that like emotional territory with it. Another thing is processing the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union collections and finding original police records on sodomy arrests and cruising arrests and indecent conduct arrests in the 70s and 80s with like handwritten notes from the cops and like their original correspondence with the legal cases was similarly really intense for me.
Hi, I'm Shan Bhattacharya, also a volunteer at Treader. So a couple of years back, there was this exhibit and I met the previous curator and she said that, oh, you should come. We have a Sri Lankan box. So I was quite like, it felt strange. Like, what does this mean? Like a Sri Lankan box? Like, are there boxes designated to different countries? But she didn't have any more information. So then when Rachel came, I spoke with her. And then we went down and found that what was called the Sri Lankan box, which is basically, so that's what I'm currently working with. It's an assortment of materials from different nonprofit groups in Sri Lanka, primarily working on queer rights. There are scarves, there are t-shirts, there are baseball caps, papers, all kinds of things in that. There's a lot of fact-finding reports on lesbian suicides there, and it speaks a lot about the way the term lesbian circulates in South Asia, how it came there, and so there is a lot of interesting material there. And besides that, the other thing that I'm working on is the South Asian diaspora's first LGBT journal, which Treader has a few copies. It's called Trikon. Trikon meaning triangle, like takes off from the Holocaust inverted triangle. So Treader has quite a few copies of that. I'm trying to catalog that as well. And there are some issues which are not there. So I'm trying to get in touch with some of the founders of Trikon and see if we can get some interviews for the collection.
Hi, I'm Rose, and I am also a student worker here at Treader. One of my favorite collections I've worked with was the Patrick Scully collections. I liked it because there were just a lot of records of different queer performing artists. And I got to watch a lot of their performances at Patrick's Cabaret. By far the best one was watching Tim Miller present My Queer Body, which I think is just such a strong and powerful piece. Other than that, I've mostly worked with company records, which are just kind of always boring.
Hi, I'm Eliza. I'm a part-time processing archival assistant.
I think what's really interesting about the Cheddar Collection is that we've all worked with such a broad range of materials. Like, for instance, Rose has worked with a lot of organizational records, and there's also people's personal papers, legal records, and ephemera, and, you know, like t-shirts and scarves and everything, like Cheyenne was saying. And I'd really love to take my time on this question to talk a little bit about correspondence, because the collections that I've worked with primarily have been composed of just shoeboxes from people's attics and basements that are just full of the letters they saved that they were writing to each other in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. Particularly Jack Baker and Michael McConnell, who were the first same-sex couple to be legally married in the United States in 1971, saved basically every piece of paper that came across their laps because they were very aware when they were getting married in the 70s that this was a significant historical moment that they should preserve as much as possible. And they eventually donated their papers to the Cheddar Collection a few years ago. And also Judith Katz, who is currently working at the University of Minnesota, who is a lesbian Jewish writer and theater maker who has spent a lot of time in the Twin Cities, has also donated a lot of her personal correspondence from the 70s onward. The ability to go through as a young queer person and be able to open people's correspondence and sort of relive those really intense personal moments in their lives where they're talking about everything from, you know, the horrors that are around us every day in the world to their personal relationships with each other is just such a powerful experience. Just to be able to look at somebody's handwriting and have a physical object is a really grounding experience in terms of processing a collection, because you're literally just going through somebody's mail, basically, and learning all sorts of things about their lives and their art and the way that they conceptualize their universes. And that's a really powerful aspect of working in an archive.
Like, what emotions for you as queer people sort of arise in working with this collection?
Earlier this summer, I was working with the Gaze TV collection, which is a collection of episodes that aired in the span from the mid-80s to the early 2000s on local access cable TV in the Twin Cities and Duluth area. And it was basically a TV show that was disseminating information about local events that were going on in LGBTQ spaces. The people who ran the show also took a lot of raw footage of events, both local and national. And because the show was started in the mid-80s, a lot of that information centered around the AIDS crisis in terms of disseminating information specifically, like PSAs about how to have safe sex and also how to engage with current news about what is AIDS and what is going on in a really tumultuous time in queer history. So when I was going through those videos, particularly the raw footage of the AIDS Memorial Quilt Project, which was a project where essentially when somebody died of AIDS, their friends and family would gather and sew a quilt square that represented this person. And all of those quilt squares combined were laid on the National Mall in the late 80s during the National March on Washington in 1987. Footage of that project, which traveled nationwide and pieces of it were displayed, because it's too large to be displayed all at once, and it's continuously growing. It's also available online if anybody is interested. It's been like largely digitized, and that's also a really powerful project to engage with that's fully accessible to anybody. But these videos of people going through the physical process of unfolding each quilt square and hearing the names of the people who have died during the AIDS crisis read out loud in, you know, auditoriums across the Twin Cities. There's footage in the Gaze TV collection at the Cheddar Collection of people doing this in Northfield at Carleton in the Metrodome during the 80s and 90s. It's really powerful footage. And something that I realized as I was watching through the episodes in this collection was that a lot of the people that I had come to know going through these videos chronologically actually had AIDS and were basically dying as I watched through this footage. And so in terms of your question about emotions, like, that was a time in my life for a few months in the summer where I would be crying at work every day because I would be watching these people trying to exercise some semblance of power and becoming frailer as the episodes of this TV show went on. And then one day I would like go to an episode and they would just be gone. And there would be people discussing their lives and what they did and what they meant to their communities. And it was a really difficult thing to grapple with as somebody who didn't live through the AIDS crisis, that there's this deeply embedded historical memory in my own body that I don't really have a framework to understand, right, as a young queer person. And so to be able to go through
that footage and find some grounding to understand what that trauma meant for a lot of the people in my life who are older than me, who were around to witness those things firsthand, was a really powerful experience.
Well, I think going off of that, it's very hard to describe the feelings that happen when you are going through someone's life with your hands, especially someone that's gone, especially their personal life. You talked about correspondence, and that's a really good example. Any kind of collection that I've worked with in here, there's been something that just shocked me and put this perspective into me, and it led to these bigger questions of, like, you know, I am going through this person's life. I am going through what this person has left behind. So, you know, what am I leaving behind? What are all of us leaving behind? Kind of. I think another really big emotion that I've always had working here has just been, like, wonder and awe. I can think of the Patrick Scully performances I've seen, or the lesbian feminist literature I've read, or the Gay House records, or whatever it's been, but, like, wonder and awe and, like, respect for, like, the past generations, and just seeing, like, what people have been able to do throughout history. And tied into that is this rage that you can feel sometimes when you go through certain records and you see what people went through, or you see the residual effects of what they went through, or the society that they were living in the material. That's all connected to me.
So I'll say something similar to what both of you were saying. What also really strikes me is, like, how what is, like, when we think of the archive is something that is thought of as frozen in the past, right? It's materials from the past. But when you're going through these materials, what is frustrating, what is disappointing, sad, tragic, like, all those emotions, like, how so much of that is still continuing. For instance, that earlier example I was giving, like, these fact-finding, these groups conducted around suicides. Now, that is something that's still happening. And so when one reads that, it's like, what has really changed? Like, the AIDS crisis that you were talking about, and I was recently reading some reports, WHO reports, like, a second crisis is about to start in the next few years. And so AIDS deaths, homophobia, suicide, transphobia, murders, like, and so much of that in those fact-finding reports and in the 80s, but we are, like, this is 2019 and not much has changed. I mean, surely things have changed, but then these violences keep happening at a very regular level. So that is really disheartening. That is one emotion that comes to mind. Then the other thing is that some of the language used in these materials can sometimes be very disturbing, because a lot of terms which are not in circulation anymore, because they're thought of as transphobic, for instance, that's the kind of language that's used there, talking about people's body parts and things like that in a manner in which we don't do it anymore. But reading that can be distressing. And as historians, as archivists, we are supposed to be trained to contextualize every term that's there in the archive, right? But then that's easier said than done, because when you're reading that, then the context doesn't always remain in the mind and reads as very offensive. And then you have to, like, oh, okay, this is a term that was in circulation in the 70s, not anymore. So let's situate it. So all these things keep playing in the mind, like the researcher, the queer person versus the archivist. That's what I'm trying to say, is like the queer person is getting offended, disturbed, but then the archivist will say that you have to historically situate that term. So it's a conflict of different emotions.
The collection that has probably triggered the most emotion in me was when I first started here. One of the first collections I went through was all of the mainstream media records that we have in Shredder about queer people or events in queer history. Kind of as Eliza talked about, there are a lot of articles and magazines and just a lot of stuff dedicated to and about the AIDS crisis. And I remember going through, like, just magazine after magazine where the first, like, 5, 10, 15 pages were just faces of people who died from AIDS, just over and over and over again. And it was so hard to get through and, like, hard to even really think about as, like, a young queer person who didn't live through the AIDS crisis but kind of still has this residual effect. And then, like, the Matthew Shepard murder, there are a lot of news articles about that. And, yeah, that collection was really hard to get through, but there are also a lot of really funny moments that have come out of that collection. So I feel like that's kind of the dichotomy of Shredder. you get really sad stuff, and occasionally you get something that you can share and all laugh about. Probably the most long-lasting example, there were a lot of articles about Cher, for obvious reasons. The best one was about Cher and one of her affairs, where she had an affair with her bagel boy, who brought her bagels, and the news article referred to him solely as her hunky bagel boy.
Yeah, I kind of feel like you get the full range at Treader. Like Rose was just saying, like, queers are really funny. And, like, some of the events or posters you pull out, like, sometimes I'm archiving, I have no idea what's in a box, and I'll just pull out, like, this giant poster, and it's, like, and it says, like, spy cock on it, and it's, like, this just, like, ridiculous artifact, but I'm really glad we have it. I kind of like to tell the story of the first time I encountered archives was when I was like 15 or 16, and actually I found Treader through a program that my high school kind of was in partnership with the Historical Society, and they kind of just brought us in and connected us archival materials and taught us that we could kind of like be in the space a little bit. I had never really, like, when you think of archives, you think of like all this bureaucracy, and it's like, oh, but like, I don't know if I really belong there. It's a really serious place. Like, do I have to register? Do I have to pay? And I had a really visceral reaction to just like kind of discovering, because like up until that point, I had had no exposure to queer history. And I was like, oh, first of all, it's not like just like me and my weird friends at our middle school. Like, there's like a whole world out here. And then also just like something that I have constantly been finding is like, sometimes we like to think of, like, we use queer like to create a community. Like, we're trying to create a group of people, but it's really difficult. And something that I've just always found so interesting is all the different pockets that can come into Treader and kind of all hold the same space. Like, we can have like two boxes from two completely different people with completely different ideas about like how the world is and should be and different life experiences right next to each other. And sometimes that's frustrating and sometimes that's happy. I really like going through old photographs. I know we touch on correspondence, but like photographs have also been incredible. And there's a couple collections that I've gone through who just like kind of like document like a lot of like the really happier moments of their lives and like moments where they formed like these like queer kinship systems, and like you're seeing family photographs, but it's just like this really queer thing.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth it in this conversation to also highlight the amount of joy that is held in our collection. Just going off what Ray was saying about like kinship networks and family, like there's so many moments where I'm going through a collection and I'll find just like a stray doodle or like a note in a love letter or just a piece of ephemera that like is a big reminder that even though the materials that are held here are materials that have survived a lot of pain and hurt that has been directed at our communities, they also, I mean, they survived and they are here and we're interacting with them now as we're going through our own struggles. And it's also really powerful to me that we have access to these things, and these things are items that we can hold in our hands today that haven't been destroyed and that have made it through all of these various decades. And those really small and large moments of joy in people's lives are also preserved here, and they're visible. And that visibility is something that I really treasure at my work here.
I also like want to add that side to side, like there's also like a lot that we don't have. There have been a couple of research topics that I've thought of that I've like come into the archive saying like, I want to think about this. And it's like, oh, we don't have anything on that. And there's a lot of reasons for why that is. I mean, a lot of communities, because they're under scrutiny from the state or from police, just do not produce stuff that archives can really keep. Like, the cultures were just, like, in the moment and shared with one another. And there's not going to be, like, a whole, like, meeting agenda with a list of names and phone numbers and addresses for us to have. And then also, there's a skill that you have to learn. Sometimes that's really annoying when you start encountering, like, older stuff where it's, like, people don't necessarily get to talk about themselves in their language or even, like, portray themselves, like, how they are, or explain their worldview. It's like all through like institutions and like the professionalization of like, oh, okay, like your way of life is now, like we built a career off of like understanding it and controlling it. Yeah, a lot of times archival work is, it's joyful, but it's also like deeply frustrating and angering because like that's just all you have of that moment in time really at your disposal.
There's sort of an opposition between like a queer archive and the University of Minnesota and the very idea of like trying to preserve like queer history, which has been so often erased. So that's a very serious topic, but I want to take a more fun route to it because I don't want the entire podcast to be very depressing. So the way I'm framing this question is, what would your ideal queer archive be?
So, yeah, I want a food house, and I want there to be more emphasis on, like, first of all, like, connecting, like, queer people who are, like, still alive. Like, I know a couple, like, older queer people, and I learn a lot from them, and I think we learn a lot from each other. And so I would like a space that fosters that relationship. I don't know if the archives necessarily does that, because it's more like Judith Katz is still alive, and I can go through her journal, but, like, it's almost weird if I, like, emailed Judith Katz, like, saying, I read this in your journal. Like, technically she consented to that. I just feel, like, weird doing it. Yeah, I would like a place where people can eat, people can sleep if they need to, but also just, like, really public communal space with a more emphasis placed on conversational history.
Going off of that, yeah, I think that the ideal queer archive is not something that is, like, separated from other institutions. To me, it should be something that's part of something so much larger, a transformative kind of reimagining of what public space means and what history means in public space. You know, if you want to come see Treader material, you come down to the university, set hours. You know, it's nominally free, but it takes time. You have to get here. There's registration. There's a specific room you use. And there's reasons that there's controlled access. But at the same time, I do think that there's more legroom than people can make in an institution like this. If you look at something like the Quatrefoil Library, I mean, those are all originals. You know, the Quatrefoil has original gay and lesbian newsletters of all types going back decades. They're housed there, but you can just go see them. You can just go read them. That's a situation where there's kind of that blending where it's not so formal to have to come in and see things under controlled conditions. So I do think that the optimal queer archive would kind of be more like a public library.
Yeah, agreeing with both Ray and Myra, I think it's really important that a queer archive would also function as a community space, somewhere where younger queer people can talk to older queer people and just have a space where they are surrounded by their own history and they are surrounded by people like them. I'm disappointed that it's so difficult to emphasize in the space we are now.
Yeah, I don't think a queer archive has any business being in a university, because university is so exclusive. And even if this place, hypothetically speaking, even if it was, like, completely accessible, even then a lot of people would not feel comfortable coming to the university, given the kind of histories of violence an institution like a university is implicated in. That's one thing. The other thing is that I would say that a queer archive is not any one thing. There are cultural differences, there are identity differences, so it has to be several things. I think one challenge personally for me is, like, the way I see it is, like, we are constantly reinventing the wheel every 10 years, so it's like, because there are very few conversations that happen across generations. So it seems like every time some group, like a new generation, is starting from scratch, but that's not the case. They are building on struggles of the previous generation. These intergenerational conversations are so very important, and they don't happen. So a queer archive should perhaps be a space which can stage these conversations over meals and sleep in all kinds of ways, because pleasure is also very important, right? So what would it mean to, like, really have that kind of I think of anti-conference, like a conference which is not an academic conference, but where people come, eat together, talk, and do whatever that's pleasurable, and have those conversations.
I am very in love with everything that you have all said. All of that together is what I want in my ideal queer archive. But that being said, I also want a massive garden. There's such an emphasis here on, like, preserving things for future generations, which I am all for, and, like, the idea of, like, putting something down deep into the caverns underneath Anderson Library that will be there maybe, like, hopefully for decades or hundreds of years, I don't know. But also I want to burn things. I want to be able to write something down and not have anybody have access to it. I want to bury it in the ground and watch something grow from it that's not seeable by anybody but me and the people in my community. I was thinking about your first question, and I also want to really emphasize that, like, there are ways to push back against the institutional nature of archives at the university specifically. And a great way to do that is to come and request materials from the archives times for fun. Come here and read gay love letters with us. Everything that is available in Anderson Library is available to the public, and it's not something that you can check out, but it is something that anybody can request and spend time within the reading room. So that is something that we actively encourage, is for anybody to come here. It can be for research, it can be if you want to write a paper, if you want to make an exhibit, but it can also be, hey, I'm really curious about the holdings of this collection, I just want to come and explore and see what it's all about.
Well, that is all for this episode of Real College Podcast. Thanks to everyone at the Charter Collection for all your help. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It is produced by Liv Riggins, Nathan Furboy, Lizzie Ritchie, and Ben Hallam. Alex Schumacher is the host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.